This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Aid agencies in South Sudan are struggling to deliver emergency food aid and other assistance as an ever-evolving myriad of armed groups makes travel more and more dangerous.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. We'll have the full story coming up.
Also, the latest on the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, Somalia, Northeast Nigeria, and Yemen. And Italy's government teams up with the Catholic Church to create a human corridor for up to 500 African refugees to enter the country.
We'll have these stories and more for you, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, UN humanitarian agencies gave an update today on the famine in parts of South Sudan and the humanitarian crises in Somalia, Northeast Nigeria and Yemen. Arif Hussein is a chief economist for the World Food Programme who had issued an early warning about the crises.
In 2017, we are looking at about 108 million people who are in food security crises. This is about 35% more than what was last year, which was 80 million people. Of these 108 million, about 30 million people are in the four countries which we have been talking about, meaning Northeast Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen. If you look at the top 13 crises in the world, food security crises in the world, nine of them are driven by conflict. And the remaining is, in fact, a combination of bad weather, floods and droughts and things like that, and sometimes the combination of conflict and bad weather, as you can see in Somalia.
He says these crises have been going on for years, mostly in rural areas, and people have lost their ability to cope.
People are unable to, let's say, farm their lands. They are unable to take their livestock out. And also they are unable to earn wages because there are no wage opportunities because agriculture is not working. So all three of these things, what they do is curtail your purchasing power. At the same time, because of the same conflict, the markets either stop to work or the prices go much, much higher.
The WFP official says those who could not flee the situation have already left, and those remaining are often trapped by insecurity and conflict. Hussein says a twin-track approach is needed.
One is obviously the political side, where you need to have a solution so these conflicts, they come to an end and people can go back to their lives and their livelihoods. But till that happens, you need two things. One of them is full humanitarian access, to be able to bring the food and other resources which these people require to them on a sustained basis, on a monthly basis. And for that to happen, obviously, you need not only financial resources, but also timely financial resources.
Well, famine has been declared in two counties in South Sudan's Unity State. Hussein outlines the conditions needed to declare a famine.
It's a famine if 20% of the population in that place is starving, and 30% of the children under 5 are suffering from acute malnutrition, and the death rate is double the average, meaning that more than 2 per 10,000 people are dying every day. Just for 1 second, think about it. You cannot feed the dead. So if you're dead, you're dead. Number two, if children are not well nourished during the first 1,000, they never recover from it in terms of their lifelong productivity. So to declare a famine, essentially what we are saying is that 30% of children in the community would never reach their full potential in terms of productivity. And then obviously the starvation. So the test for famine is so severe that we should do everything in our power to in fact avoid that.
The WFP economist says the humanitarian response in the four countries must continue for at least another 6 months until the next harvest. He warns, however, the forecast for the coming rainy season is not good.
Aid agencies in South Sudan are struggling to deliver emergency food aid and other assistance as an ever-evolving myriad of armed groups makes travel more and more dangerous. VOA's East Africa correspondent Jill Craig explains.
Ending the conflict and preventing more famine in South Sudan are entwined, but the situation on the ground only grows more complex.
We have a much more chaotic situation on the ground than, let's say, 2 years ago when we had one government, one armed opposition.
Casey Copeland, senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, says there are now dozens of armed opposition groups.
A handful of them are able to engage the government in pitched battles. Others simply don't have any means to actually fight the government. So the most they can do are things like road ambushes of government convoys and things like that. But at the same time, of course, that means also road ambushes of anyone, and a situation of rebellion can then easily start to look like general banditry and insecurity.
The confusion is not limited to the opposition. Allied militia operate on the government side as well. Witnesses to recent attacks on civilians in Wau and Equatoria have said the attackers were men in uniform. Sometimes it is not clear whether attackers are soldiers, militia, or rebels. Ken Isaacs is vice president of programs and government relations at U.S.-based charity Samaritan's Purse, whose staff members were briefly held captive in Mayandit, one of two counties in Unity State where the U.N. has declared a famine.
We had several weeks ago some people that were abducted in Mayandit, right in the middle of the famine area. And the people that took them was an offshoot of one of the armed sides, and they were acting unilaterally of their own volition. So they didn't have orders. They just thought that was a good thing to go do, is to kidnap those guys, you know, to abduct them.
The violence has a ripple effect. Take Equatoria, for example. Copeland calls it the food belt of South Sudan, a key breadbasket and transit point. She says that fighting there has cut off food supplies to other parts of the country. The chaos has made it even harder for aid agencies to operate. The UN said Wednesday that the conflict has killed 82 aid workers and displaced 3.5 million people since it began in December 2013. The UN has warned repeatedly of a looming genocide in South Sudan, but Copeland cautions against calling this an ethnic conflict, pitting President Salva Kiir's Dinka tribe against that of former vice president and opposition leader Riek Machar's Nuer.
When we look at the transitional government, what we don't see is what a lot of people say, is that it is sort of a Dinka domination. Actually, we find ministers from Equatoria, the national security minister is an Equatorian. We find senior Nuer in several different key ministries. So we do see that calling it an ethnic conflict, or as some would say tribal, it's too simplistic, actually.
John Mukum Mbaku is an economics professor at Weber State University and works on African governance issues. He says that South Sudan's political leaders on both sides are to blame for the situation.
These are highly educated people. These are people who understand the consequences of violence, and yet they are still not willing to sit down and try to prevent this violence from taking place. And I think that if they don't do something about it, history will remember them not as nationalists who tried to develop a country, but as monsters who were specifically interested only in their own personal interests.
Violence against civilians has escalated since the breakdown of a 2015 peace deal. The UN and the government have projected that by July, roughly half of the country will be severely food insecure. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says violence and insecurity in Nigeria's Borno state are forcing thousands of people to flee to remote towns. At the same time, it says Cameroon's military is forcibly returning some Nigerian refugees to Borno. A Cameroon military official says about 7,000 Nigerians were voluntarily repatriated last month, adding that they were given food and medical care if needed. Doctors Without Borders operates 12 medical facilities in 7 towns in Borno State. Heather Pagano is the representative for the group, also known as MSF. From the Borno State capital, Maiduguri, she spoke to VOA's Joe DeCapua about the ongoing insecurity.
Well, today we're still seeing large numbers of people that are forced to flee their homes in Borno State in northeast Nigeria. We're seeing big waves of new displaced that are arriving into remote towns that are difficult to reach and to supply for medical supplies, food, and this sort of thing. In the past couple of months, in a town called Puka, for example, 11,000 people have arrived since January. So now it's more than 42,000 people living in this very small town. Why is this concerning? It's not just an issue of numbers for us. In Puka, for example, that people are living on about 5 liters per person per day, which is far below the minimum standards. That's for drinking, for washing, for everything. And actually, Puka is the town that's entirely built on rock. So to drill for more water isn't possible. So if we continue to see big population displacements to towns like this that are already overstretched in terms of resources, it's very concerning indeed because they just can't physically cope with the extra amounts of people that are arriving.
When you say they are fleeing to remote towns, how far do they have to travel to get there?
It depends on where you're talking about. There are these remote towns that are kind of like islands in a sea of insecurity in the countryside. So people flee their homes either because of violence from military operations or attacks by the insurgency group Boko Haram, or sometimes they're actually searching for basic food and services. So it depends. Sometimes people tell us they had to walk for many days. Sometimes people are very afraid to travel during the day and, in fact, flee at night. Sometimes people are brought by the military themselves, actually, whenever they go to a new town and conduct their operations, and then people are brought to these bigger towns where they're kept. It's an ongoing process that we're seeing a lot of right now, especially because it's dry season. So this is when we see an increase in military operations, of course, because they're easier to move around the state. And so, therefore, population displacement takes place on a larger scale.
What is the condition of the people that MSF is seeing?
So people often arrive in a pretty bad state. Sometimes they have absolutely nothing, especially those that were forced to flee in the middle of the night because their village might have been attacked. Sometimes they're even separated from their family members. So, of course, then we're treating people for malnutrition. As soon as people arrive in these towns, we do a medical screening for the children. We do vaccinations against measles, which is a big threat when large groups of people come together. We provide people with food to get them through until they can be registered in the official food distribution programs. And then, of course, if we see anyone who is in need of urgent medical care, they are referred then to our facilities in these towns.
Now, Doctors Without Borders is also concerned about what's happening in Cameroon. You're saying that the Cameroon military is forcibly making Nigerians return to Borno State. Is that correct?
On several occasions in 2016 and 2017, we have witnessed Nigerians who sought safety in Cameroon being forcibly returned to Nigeria by the Cameroonian military. So we've had patients tell us we were not asked to be returned to our country. They forced us. We didn't have a choice. And this isn't to say everyone who is returning to Nigeria from Cameroon is being forced, but it is to say that we are seeing this practice take place multiple times over the past year and a half, and it's extremely concerning.
Have you seen the security situation in Borno State improve at all?
It depends on what you're talking about, I suppose. I mean, the security situation in these isolated towns, like I said, they're kind of like islands of security and they're surrounded by the military, and they have less security issues apart from suicide bombings, which do happen on occasion, even here in the capital, Maiduguri. But overall, in the state, the ongoing operations are taking place in lots of locations. In many of these places, it means we can't go to.
Heather Pagano is a spokesperson for Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. She spoke from Maiduguri to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Italy's government and the Catholic Church have teamed up to create a new initiative to help African refugees enter the country. They say they'll create a humanitarian corridor for up to 500 migrants from Eritrea, Somalia, and South Sudan. The refugees are now living in Ethiopian refugee camps, but will be transferred to Italy over the next 2 years. The humanitarian corridor is not a new concept. A similar transfer was done for Syrian refugees. However, it will be a first for Africans. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me about the initiative and other migrant news as well.
Well, the Italian government, working with the Catholic Church and the Catholic charity Caritas and a local Catholic charity called the Community of Sant'Egidio, are working together to create what's known as a humanitarian corridor to help transfer 500 Eritrean, Somali and South Sudanese refugees from Ethiopian refugee camps to Italy over the next 2 years. Now, the same organizations with the government have already done this, welcoming Syrian refugees. This is the first time they're going to do this to help African refugees. So it's considered a great breakthrough, even though the numbers, of course, are in the hundreds, and we're still seeing thousands of migrant arrivals by boat across the Mediterranean.
What has been the response of the Ethiopian government to this?
Well, the Ethiopian Deputy Foreign Minister, Ms. Harout Zemene, met with the Italian delegation and has welcomed this humanitarian action, which she said was directed at the most vulnerable people, also recognized how important Italy was in helping migrants and its commitment to help migrants transfer to Italy at what is considered to be quite a difficult time. At the moment, the delegation is making its first reconnaissance in the camps in the Tigray region on the border with Eritrea, and that's being facilitated by a local NGO known as the Gandhi Charity.
And also in another matter, Libyan fishermen discovered bodies. Can you tell us about this?
We've had reports that Libyan fishermen found the bodies of 28 migrants who appeared to have died tragically from thirst and hunger after their boat broke down off the coast of Sabratha. Now, we know that Libya is pretty much in a state of chaos and lawlessness, with many militias running different parts of the country. And the North African country, as we know, has been the main departure point for migrants traveling from sub-Saharan Africa trying to reach Europe by sea. The latest figures show that we've had more than 30,000 arrivals in Italy just this year. But this is a terrible tragedy. 28 migrants, including four women, were found by these fishermen who towed the vessel to shore, and the victims were buried in a cemetery for illegal migrants in Libya.
Very sad to hear that news. Also, I understand that SOS Mediterranean, they too are painting a bleak picture of what is going on in Libya. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, this French NGO, SOS Mediterranean, has really come out very strongly saying that it's absolute hell for migrants in Libya. We had an update from the organization in Rome yesterday. The organization has rescued nearly 17,000 migrants in the last year of its operations, and it works very closely with Médecins Sans Frontières, a Doctors Without Borders. Now, the officials say that people are escaping rape, violence, food deprivation, slavery in Libya, and the organization said it's an absolute living hell. And it also noted that one quarter of the migrants that it is rescuing are minors, many of them unaccompanied minors. So it's very concerned about the situation and trying to ensure that people's lives are protected and their human rights are protected as they make that journey through Libya to Europe.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome.
Moving to Southern Africa now, and two of Zimbabwe's opposition leaders have taken a step towards forming a coalition for next year's presidential election. The Associated Press reports Morgan Tsvangirai of the MDC-T party and former Vice President Joyce Mujuru have agreed to form a united front to take on 93-year-old President Robert Mugabe. Mugabe sacked Mujuru in 2014, accusing her of trying to unseat him.
Terrorism and the fear of terrorism are problems the world over. A new study says it's important to distinguish between radical and extreme beliefs and terrorist acts. It says failing to do so may create a climate that can actually lead to more attacks. That's according to the findings by Bryn Mawr College social psychologist Clark McCauley and Sophia Moskalenko. The study has been published in a special issue of the journal American Psychologist. In the first of a two-part interview, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Professor McCauley about the role that pure emotion plays in the making the leap from extremist beliefs to terrorist acts.
There is very little attention to the emotional side of political radicalization, especially radicalization to action. Now, once upon a time, it was a great advance to go from thinking that terrorists must be crazy to thinking that, no, actually, they're rational calculators. They're trying to make a difference in the world, and their actions are in the direction of trying to get the results that they want. That was an improvement over thinking that terrorists are crazy, but it's still not enough. We got to understand the power of emotions, anger and shame, humiliation especially, to bring people to be ready to do desperate and violent things.
How are you able to come to these conclusions? Why is this not just mere speculations that violent people must be angry or humiliated and therefore angry?
Well, we get this idea by looking at a lot of case history material. In our book, Friction, Sophia and I looked at examples all the way from anti-czarist terrorists through 1970s university terrorists. That would be the Weather Underground in the U.S. or the Red Brigades in Italy, up through the recent jihadist terrorists. And in all of these case histories, as soon as you get into reading about these people and to read what they thought and what they wrote and what they said, you realize you're dealing with people who are up to their elbows in emotion. So it seemed to us that that was more than just an accident. Like, people take chances with their lives and sacrifice their lives and do terrible things, partly at least because of the emotions that they're feeling.
Now, you're a social psychologist. You study groups. Tell me how this field of study has helped you to understand terrorist opinion making and also alongside it, and sometimes separate from it, terrorist acts.
Well, if you want to understand radicalization to action, you mostly have to understand small group dynamics. How it is when you put like-minded people together and they start exchanging and communicating in a small group, there's a whole lot of processes that get put in play. Status competitions and persuasion by just repeating what other people say and having all those common opinions reinforce one another. So the power of emotion in a small group has partly to do with the emotions of the group members with relation to one another.
Is there some sort of psychological trigger that gets tripped that makes somebody go from having terrorist or extreme opinions to actually acting to hurt others, you know, in a terrorist act?
There is no single trigger like that. Some of the mechanisms include personal revenge and some kind of group or political grievance, or love for somebody who's already a member, or just escaping some bad things in your own life, or seeking the status of power and a gun in your hand. These are all reasons why individuals join a group. But once they join a group, there's new mechanisms. Like, there's a competition for status within a group. Who can be the most extreme? Who is most ready to sacrifice for the group and its cause? And that kind of competition within a group pushes the whole group in the direction of more extreme thoughts and more extreme behavior.
I assume there must be some very intimate dovetailing between the values of a culture and the incitement or the igniting of emotions that will lead to violence.
Well, you might think that, but that's the kind of line that leads you into believing that radicalization is all just one progression from bad ideas to bad action. But it's not like that. We got a whole lot of research in social psychology that shows that the relation between opinion or attitude on the one hand and action on the other hand is usually very weak unless you take special steps to strengthen it. Like, a voting booth is one of our ways as a society for trying to increase the strength of the relation between an attitude or opinion on the one hand and action, you know, flipping the switch in the voting booth on the other. But in everyday life, and most of the time, this connection is not very strong. So you have to be careful about thinking that bad ideas produce directly bad actions. It's not like that.
That was Clark McCauley, research professor of psychology at Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania. McCauley spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews? Analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.